Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Low Post. Latest episode is a conversation about the intersection of basketball and social injustice in Atlanta with Hawks coach Lloyd Pierce and the WNBA's Renee Montgomery about sitting out the 2020 season to focus on reform. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to The Low Post now as well as the right time wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's that type of week where we bring a guest on. Joining us now, I got the visual on him so I can see him. He's still suited up from doing his television. Dominique Foxworth, what's going on?
I'm happy to be here. I noticed that we both, our hair has been growing for a little while, and I noticed that you're doing the same thing that I can't stop myself from doing.
Twisted your hair?
You just start twisting it. Like, yes. I haven't had long hair in just about all of my life, and I forgot that it's like a magnet from your fingers to twisting while you're sitting around. I do it all the time now.
I'm doing it because I miss it. I've been without hair for 7 years, and I forgot how luxurious it feels just running these long fingers through it, man. You know what I'm saying? I try to talk about what I used to have to do to run my fingers through my hair, but I feel like it's an inappropriate joke for the format. You know what I'm saying?
That's one of your best skills, I think. And I'm learning it myself is to be able to censor yourself because I'll be having some hotlines that are only for the group texts or for my buddies. We were on Get Up this morning and Jay Cutler said that his cat was a savage with loose morals. And I had so many lines to come off of that, but I can't do it on Get Up. I've gotten in trouble before for going to working a little through blue on first take. So I just kept it to myself. I'll text you my joke later.
Yeah, it's a little time and place situation. What I find in those cases is what I'd like to do is I like to use other people's overreaction against them, right? So like on the podcast the other day, what I was talking about, instead of putting the interracial dap on the front of Bubba Wallace's car, how about a picture of him and his girlfriend? Why you gonna be mad at me?
That's
what I say. Just saying, what I say.
You got, I'm telling you, that is one, it's one of the underappreciated skills that you have is knowing those little moves. So like I was listening to the, your debate with Will Kane. I mean, I don't know that we call it a debate, but your discussion with Will Kane on his show that got a lot of
interaction.
Yeah, your interaction with him that got a lot of reaction. And less so your argument, while your argument was sound, I was more impressed with how you argue. Like the skills that you use, because you would ask Will questions, he would answer those questions, he would essentially paint himself in the corner. I think the saying is you give him enough rope, but that saying may not be appropriate for this discussion.
Yes.
And then he would ask you questions, and rather than answer the questions that he asked, you would turn his questions into making the point that you had probably decided you wanted to make before. And I was listening. Everyone talks about how you're a good debater. I was like, these are the skills. And then you planted that benefit of the doubt line. You set it all up. And then towards the end, it was just jabs. You were just stabbing him with that benefit of the doubt. Benefit of the doubt. I was like, man, this is, and you did it the whole time. One of the things that I've developed since I've become a debater, like First Take and Get Up, like a lot of sports stuff is debates. One of the things I've developed is like a Stephen A-ism to some of this where it's like performance. It's like big and loud and like faces and all that stuff because people like that. But I've noticed that you don't do any of that. And it is just, it's just as entertaining, almost more, where it's just chill. It's just chill shots. I don't know whose basketball game I would analogize it to, but it's just, it's Dr. J. It's smoothish. It's not tomahawks. It's just smooth.
Let me just kind of lay out to people how we wound up here, right? Because, you know, obviously I got Dominique. I won't talk to Dominique, but we homies and all this stuff. And me and Dominique have a little shared Will Kane history as it relates to a week of radio back in 2016, right?
That's a perfect example of me not knowing when to use my joke. But that one worked out well, I would say.
Oh, man. All right, so this is a little background, and it's not like it's a little background. So in 2016, I was hosting a radio show from 4 to 7, and I took a week off. It was vacation. I took a week off. So Friday of 1 week is my last day at work, right? And then the next week was the last week of August, and I was coming back the day after Labor Day. Got it. So Friday, I signed off the air at 7. That night, in Santa Clara, Colin Kaepernick, for the first time that anybody noticed, did not stand for the national anthem. Coincidentally, filling in on my radio show the next week was Will Kane and Kay Fagan. That was a hell of a break, man. That was the universe coming together in a way. And imagine if you are expecting to hear me talk about Colin Kaepernick and you get Will Kane, right? Like, not terribly dissimilar from you were expecting Will Kane to talk about Colin Kaepernick, and then you got me. And man, my phone was blowing up, my apps were blowing up, and it was everybody coming over and being like, yo, you need to come back and kick this dude up out your crib. Like, I don't know if you've ever gotten a phone call from your own house of somebody telling you, you need to come home and kick these people out of your place. This was one of those. Dominique was one of those people, and I'll never forget it, because Dominique had done outside the lines either that day or the next day with Will, and it got a little heated, and then Dominique was a guest, and then Dominique picked right back up from where it was, and then they were rolling. Michael Smith got on there talking to Will. Will wasn't trying to hear it. Mike called him after the show and talked to him for like an hour, because I had to call in because I just had to let everybody know that it was going to be okay. I was a guest
on the show, and I never met Will before. I was a guest on your show, and Will was hosting. I never met Will before, and I started off by kind of making fun of him and saying how much of a travesty it was that Will Kane is hosting in this moment, and he got hot off the jump. So he got angry for real. Like, he was offended. Like, you don't know me. So then we yelled back and forth. We made up later, and I was a decent guy. Like,
that's
Will
the thing.
Going forward, yeah.
We're okay with Will. Like, I think that's something that people kind of need to understand on a day-to-day interactive basis. And me and Will have something that we can bond over, which is complaining about white liberals, right? Like that's the thing. Like that's what we come together like Voltron and be like, yo, what's this gonna be? Like, when we want to do that, we can do that. So anyway, that had happened on the radio show before, but I had made a resolution to myself that I didn't really want to do a lot of radio or television with Will. And that's not because of any animus that I had toward him. But what I didn't want to wind up with is like people trying to turn this into like some kind of salt and pepper, like cage fight debate sort of thing. Like, I didn't want that to become a thing. It wasn't anything personal about him. I just felt like doing those kinds of things would wind up becoming a joke. And I just didn't think that maybe it served him, but it damn well wouldn't have served me.
Right.
And so I didn't want to participate in that. So we fast forward and I'm watching and I see First Take come on, and Will hadn't been on First Take in a while. And I checked out the clip of him talking about the Bubba Wallace situation with Stephen A. and Max. And as I heard it, I was going to tweet about it, but then I was like, nah, I don't think that's the best way to go about this for a number of reasons, right?
The same reaction. I got a story to tell you after you're done. Yes. About a phone conversation that Will and I had that same night, but go ahead.
Yeah. But I didn't want to do that. I just didn't think that would be appropriate. And so my man Nuno used to work on The Right Time when The Right Time was on the radio. Nuno works on the show now. And so I hit Nuno and I said, hey, man, you got some slots? And the reason I did that, and this is something that I do think you have to give Will credit for. The reason that I did that was I knew that Will would agree to have me on, because Will ain't no punk in that way, right? Like, Will is willing to have an exchange of ideas back and forth. And I appreciate that and I respect that. And so it was kind of him to offer up his space. Because look, I tell you this, I don't know if I've ever said this out loud, but this happened when Colin worked here. Colin once did a segment that was based on something I said on television, right? Like, he's talking specifically about the things that I was talking about.
Don't say it.
I don't remember what the topic was, to be honest, but he was specifically talking.
Did he then not have you on?
I called the board and was like, hey, let Colin know. Like, we can talk. Because I figured that made more sense than like chopping up what I was doing or whatever. Like, if you want to do this, we can talk. And whoever was working the phones that day hit me back and was like, nah, he doesn't want you to come on. And Colin's thing was, if you want to talk about it, you should talk about it on your own show. Right. That's what I'm saying. So I say that to say, Colin, who is as good at doing this job as just about anybody in the world is, Colin didn't have me on there. And so I decided I'll be on with Will about this coup. Right. You know, we could talk about it. And I really had one question, and I was curious how he was going to react to that one question. And the question was the one I asked him, which is, what do you think is the biggest impediment to race relations in America? And so we'll talk for a minute about like this concept of tribalism. And I think that's the problem we have, is that people just kind of want to go to their own groups and da 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 and so forth and so on and everything else, which to me is a long-winded both sides.
Right.
Because that's like when you talk about it as tribalism, you are saying that the problem is people. And American history has clearly indicated that the problem with race relations is white people. There's just no way around this fact. You can't turn it into anything else, because the whole basis of this is white people having power and keeping power away from other people. So there's at no point that black tribalism ever affects white people's lives. It doesn't come. I mean, maybe like you want to be a rapper. You know what I'm saying? You know, like you had the ABCD camp, right? Maybe that's a place where the tribalism, you know, might get you in trouble.
Young white cornerback.
Yeah, right. But even then, white people still making off the money, But you know what's funny about the white cornerbacks? I don't know if you know Dustin Fox. Dustin Fox played at Ohio State. You know, DB played a little in the league. And I remember him tweeting about this. And he said that here are the people who told me that I could be an NFL corner. And I just remember two of the names, Mike Tomlin and Mel Tucker. It ain't even us doing it to y'all. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So Will talked about that, and he said the tribalism and everything else. And that's where I hit him back, and I said, all right, so in 1865, what do you think is the greatest impediment to race relations? And my plan was to walk that out and go to 1965. And then to say, so when does it go? But I realized, okay, that was going to take too long. But I said 1865, it was like, it's the institution of slavery. But even that answer is incorrect. The impediment to race relations were the people who instituted the slavery, not the institution of the slavery itself. Like, people just got to be honest. It's a very particular thing in this country, and we give white people a benefit of the doubt on all kinds of madness. We have allowed white people to get away with all kinds of madness, like whether it be via the state or via individual actors, or sometimes we decide to let individual actors take on the power of the state. Right? Like, this is a story I tell. It's from a book called White Flight by Kevin Cruz. I've talked about it on Twitter. I don't know if I've talked about it on this podcast, but he talked about how the trolley cars used to be segregated in Atlanta, front to back. White people in the front, black people in the back. And so one day, black dude was in his work clothes and his overalls, and he got on the front because he got out trying to catch the trolley, and the conductor told him to go to the back. And he said, I can't go to the back because I'm in my work clothes, I'm dirty, and then I'll rub against these good white folks, and then it'll be a problem. And so the dude came at him with a tire tube. And the brother got his hands on the tire tool, and the rabbit had the gun, beat the dude within inches of his life. The next day, they deputized every trolley car conductor and gave them revolvers. Right? Like, the enforcers of the racial order and hierarchy, if there was no police in place or no actual power in place, then they assigned the nearest white man to be that power. You have no stories of black people who are like this. That's not what it is. So, like, I wanted to just ask that question and see where it went. And then from there, we wound up having a discussion of sorts. You can decide how you felt it went. I don't think there's any need to go to the scorecards. But no, I just looked up and was just like, I might as well ask this man his question and see ultimately what he winds up saying about it. And I think Will does deserve a little bit more credit, because most of y'all know damn well that if I called up your radio show and said, I want to talk about it, you would your pants.
I love Will Cain for that, because it feels like him, Paul Feinbaum in some occasions. I am so rarely talking to the people that I'm talking to as much as I'm talking through them to people who believe and understand that. So many people who are on the air have similar feelings, but they are afraid to say them. And I appreciate that Will is not afraid to say them, and then also not afraid to engage in them. And that's part of what our conversation was about. But when I was listening to you guys' discussion, I was thinking that I wanted Will to push you more, to get more out of you, but he wasn't asking or saying the things that I feel like should be asked. Because in that situation, when he's saying that tribalism is the issue, and you're pushing back by saying that it's actually the behavior of white people, what I thought that he could have asked you or challenged you is, if all people are or are not created equal, and we assume that they're all the same, then you should also assume that in a similar situation, a similar circumstance, people would act similarly. So I think that was his way to like try to buttress his argument. I don't actually agree with it, but his way to buttress his argument in that situation and to see how do you respond is by saying that white people did evil things and got power. However, what perpetuated this was them being human, and to suggest that black people were incapable of this is to suggest that there are differences in the races, which suggests that they should be treated differently. And I mean, I would have been interested to hear you rebut.
Oh yeah, I can tell you that. The problem is this. Race only exists for the purpose of racism.
Sure.
That's the whole thing about this. The only reason that race as a concept exists is so that white people can be over the rest of them.
Right.
Like, that's the whole reason this thing was instituted. It wasn't like everybody came together and was like, all right, guys, like they had the conference of the races. You know, like everybody got together, like the five families, and they decided to split up some territory. And then it was like every man for themselves. And then they go for it. No, race is the offshoot of racism. Like the initial thing was we're going to subjugate these people.
Right.
And then from there, everything else was built around the subjugation. And I do imagine that it can be difficult for some white people to like really come to terms and.
Hold on. Can I stop you there for a second? I'm not as learned as you or the historian that you are, but there was subjugation and hierarchy within white societies and within.
Within.
Right. No, I agree. So I'm saying that that would suggest that it is human nature to do that sort of thing.
Right.
The fact that within black societies, it happened too. The fact that it took place in this way for us, and you saying that white people's behavior is it, suggests that white people are only people capable of doing that, which I don't think is historically accurate necessarily.
I don't know. I would not make the argument that white people are the only people who are capable of doing this. However, we don't really have any historical evidence of anybody else getting on boats and just running up on people. Right. Like we don't, there is no analog to the slave traders coming to Africa to take slaves and then bring them back. There is no example of Africans doing this. There is no example the way that the West colonized Asia and all these other places. We don't have examples of this coming back the other way. And like this totally baked in, not one ethnic group, right? But a color of people. We don't have the evidence of anybody else doing this, right? So of course we got all kinds of things.
So then why? I mean, it's a waste of time philosophical argument. We can move off of it.
Yeah.
But then that question is, why is that the reason that we only
that's
have
a good question.
Group?
Right. I do wonder that. All right. And I don't have the answer for that. But in the United States, the indisputable part is we ain't done nothing to them. Not only have we not done anything to them, like on this macro level, the government and white power structures have done it to literally, in some form or fashion, every group of people.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's what I mean. It happened to our Asian brothers.
Uh-huh.
It's happened to our Latino brothers. And good gracious, it's happened to our sisters of all sorts. But like this is the direction that it's gone in. And it's not my fault that it happened that way. And we don't get anywhere from denying that fact. And so much of what we have in our society is built and baked in to that place that we started in. So I mean, people are like, I'm not responsible for the history. Nobody can be separated from the history, because from where this initial point is affects where we are right now. And it always will. And so you can't reap the benefits of the past sins and then not want to take any measure of responsibility for perpetuating what those sins were. You just can't do that.
So yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a waste of time philosophical argument, but I would have liked to see Will challenge you there. I'm happy that we were able to have that discussion, but it don't matter because that's philosophical. Yeah. We live in a practical world, and in a practical world, this is what we got because of what was done. So
yeah,
that, and you started to touch on something that I assume that Will would be comfortable with me sharing, that we had a conversation, because after I saw that tweet, I, like you, was like, I'm about to roast him on the internet. And then I like realizing myself that I was really, if I was doing it on Twitter, I was going to be doing it in order to perform, in order for everybody to be like, hey, you got him. And so I text him and was like, look, man, what you said is wrong. You cool if we do this on Twitter? Because when I was reading his thread, it seemed so personal. And I was like, man, is there something else going on? So he texted me, was like, I'm going to call you in 20 minutes. So we had a conversation about it, and I felt better after having the conversation. But we did, I think the three of us, we understand and we feel comfortable with one particular criticism. And I said this to Will on the call that we had, whereas the stuff that he said about, I don't remember the exact word he used, but he kind of talked about grandstanding and people using this as an opportunity to further themselves professionally. Like, I wholeheartedly agree with him on that for different reasons. Like, this whole process to me, it's felt like There are some people, and I'm not perfect, so I'll throw myself out of this conversation altogether, but there's some people who it seems this is 100% opportunistic, where there are some white people in media who want to come off as woke and come off and say stuff about how they are discovering new things and at work. And like their main goal in this moment is to be viewed as on the right side, but they actually don't believe the stuff they're saying. They actually are not taking any action to address the things that they're saying. That's one group. And then there's another group of black people that have frustrated me because it feels like they are so ready and willing to say the shit that white people want to hear because it will make them feel better and it'll make them be celebrated and people will appreciate them. And that frustrates me because I'm like, we got this moment to tell the truth and you using this moment to try to, I have so many insults that are coming to my mouth that I'm not going to say, but to try to cozy up that frustrates me. And we came from different angles, but we agreed on that.
Yeah. I think there's something to that, but my problem, I don't know if a problem is the way to put it, but you think Will ain't performing?
Oh, no, I absolutely
no,
think.
No. But this is the thing, because I like, and this is not just, this isn't really specific to him as much as it is to really a certain whole wing of people. A wing is the wrong word to use because it obviously has a different connotation, but you'll get where I'm coming from here, which is I'm the one that's telling the truth. Everybody else is out here performing. No, you know, like the dismissal that everybody else is out here just saying what they think they're supposed to say. Like, you can't use that argument with me. I don't operate in that space, right? So, like, you can't be the only one that cares about the truth. Everybody else is a sheep, but you're going to be the, and I don't think he uses that language to be clear, so I don't want to be too hyperbolic about it. But that's my thing on that one, is if you look and you feel like there's a measure of performance that's going on, there's also a measure of performance that one could argue goes on in his setup. And, I mean, look, man, y'all read the news. Y'all see what Will's next job is.
Yeah.
If I wanted to, and I'm not, I don't think this is what he's doing, but somebody could very easily look up and be like, hey man, you ain't been on this TV show in who knows how long. And now you pop up as the contrarian voice in this way on the Bubba Wallace situation with talking points that will fit in very nicely at the next place that you're going to work. Somebody could very easily say that same thing about him. And if somebody said that about him, he would lose his mind about it, right? It would be that you don't know me. And all of that would be fair to him. But one side can't be the only one that's telling the truth.
Right.
And everybody else is just making this up.
Right.
That simply cannot be what it is. And with Wallace, I think the whole story with Wallace, I think, is very interesting. And I got questions about the way the whole thing actually went. I will say though, while I was doing the podcast on Tuesday, and if you go back and listen to our podcast on Tuesday, you notice there was like one mention made the whole way about the noose. Like, it wasn't really discussed. That wasn't where I was coming from. But one of my buddies, while I was doing it, hit me up and he's like, look, I study these things like professionally. He's like, I study these acts of racism. He's like, this one, I don't think this is playing the way that people think it is. And he gave me his reasons and I was like, oh, okay. And then it turned out like, not to be what it was. But what everybody around NASCAR seems to be saying is maybe that thing was there since October, but please understand it was a noose.
Yeah.
You know, like they've made it clear that the pull that was on that garage did not look like the pulls on the other garages. Like, however else we got here, it was perfectly reasonable for somebody to think that a hate crime had occurred. And it is ridiculous to me, this idea that all these things can happen, all these hate crimes can happen everywhere. And then when something looks dead ass like a hate crime, somebody's going to pop up and be like, hold on, we've got to give people the benefit of the doubt. Nobody at all got accused, right? Like, these folks are offended at the idea that somebody would think that white people might do this. Not a white person,
right,
but that white people might do this. And that's where I'm like, how many more white people got to do it before you believe? You know, like, this really was, it walked like a duck, it talked, it quacked like a duck, it did all the things like a duck. It turned out not to be a duck. Yeah. But if you're more upset with the people that were like, hey, there's a duck?
That the analogy I used on Get Up this morning was NASCAR saw a fin in the water and they yelled shark. We all got out. And the people who are yelling at NASCAR and not yelling at the sharks that were circling the stadium with Confederate flags, like, you telling on yourself. And
yes,
like, you are telling on yourself because, to me, fundamentally, and this is another thing that I feel like fits into the category of respectability politics that a lot of older and particularly successful black people find themselves doing, where they aim their criticism at the good guys in this case. And in this case, NASCAR is the good guy.
Yes.
And if you have used this opportunity to point out how NASCAR is being overzealous in this moment, and you have passed up the opportunity to point out how they were overzealous in the other direction for their entire history, or you have decided to not use this as an opportunity to talk about the sharks circling the stadium, then you are telling on yourself and you are putting this pressure on the good guys. And it's founded in this nonsensical belief that all we got to do is be better. Like if we are better, the bad guys will switch teams. They ain't switching teams. Like, why are you aiming at us talking about just do better? All you got to do.
Don't hurt our feelings.
Yeah. If you work hard enough, you can overcome this. And it happens a lot with successful black people because they've had some success and they've worked really hard and they've overcome a lot. And they're looking back like, man, y'all just got to work so much harder and you can overcome this racism too. Shut up. No, we can't. Or no, they can't. Like, it's not the case.
All right, we'll be back in a minute with more with Dominique Foxworth. But first, you heard us talking about Hims and how they're helping guys look their best. If you haven't yet, it's time to see what they're all about. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35, and it's a big problem. I mean, look, you saw what I got now, though. I still got hair, but I could have done something about the front if I started a little sooner. Why do guys sit there and do nothing about it when they can turn to medicine and science? Once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. Here's to personal growth. It's time to write a new chapter, one in which you have hair. The only solution is for Hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. It's prescription solutions backed by science. No more awkward in-person doctor visits or long pharmacy lines. For Hims connects you to real doctors online. It can save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. And right now, my listeners can get started with their first month free. Go to forhims.com/Bomani. That's forhims.com/Bomani. Prescription requires an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Offer valid only if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Remember, that's forhims.com/Bomani. Let me tell you who I got some props for in this one. Bubba Wallace.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I have liked about this is, look, man, if you've gone in on something and it don't turn out to be what it seemed like, and that mass of white people builds up on the other side, like I told you, I have personally had like a front row seat on two hoaxes of various level of like national significance. Uh-huh. One, when I was in Claremont, I went back from spring break after I had graduated, and I'm there, and they got one of them walls, you know, white schools, they got that. They always got a wall that you can just come spray paint on or whatever. They love that stuff. Anyway, it started to become a thing. And then this one professor said that her car, a white lady, said that her car had been vandalized and I think anti-Semitic stuff was put on it. And those kids have been through so much hell, right? And they out there and they in the quad and they having these meetings. I remember seeing this girl standing on something and just like yelling and crying. Like it was just this, all this pain that these people of color had felt from being in what they felt was a hostile environment and nobody hearing them. And now finally they had a chance for somebody to hear them. And it turned out that lady tore up her own car. And they found out that she had a history of making up stuff and everything else. Now the other hoax of sorts that I had a front row seat in happened in 2006 in Durham with the lacrosse team at Duke. Right. I was there for that, right? And this is with a story in the newspaper, the paper of record for that area, a story in the newspaper verifying this. And I watched everything that happened at Duke and I watched those same students and everything else and all the pain that they had expressed from their time at Duke and all the things they had gone through and everything else. And then it all got ignored.
Right.
It was like it all didn't happen because of that hoax. And so many black people who reasonably believed the district attorney when he said that a crime had been committed, right? Like if you black and a white man say he gonna go after the rich white boys, look, we know what you stepped into. What? No, let me tell you this. If that DA in Durham had been black, that case don't never go through. Cause we would have been like, hey dog, I'm gonna tell you right now. Like if you making this up, they gonna destroy you.
Yeah.
And they destroyed him. Right. They took his whole life apart after it happened. But we are thinking, and as a reasonable thought for a lot of people, you wouldn't do this if it did not happen. You wouldn't be stupid enough to push this, right? And so they thought that this happened. And then it turned out that it did not. And now the lacrosse team and the people around them, they suing everybody, right? They getting people fired. They taking all this down. And every black person that had all those concerns that they had about Duke and everything they were going through, they all, everybody just had to shut up and fall back. And Bubba Wallace, after this thing happened, he was like, oh, no, 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 no. That was a nuke, right? Like he was not going to get gaslit by these people who were telling him that it wasn't what, like, it may not have gone the way it went, but he's like, no, man, I'm telling you. And everybody at NASCAR is like, no, but we saw, like, understand. Basically, the people are like, you think we don't know what a garage pull is? You think them boys in there don't know what a noose look like?
Yeah. I think that's important. So maybe it wasn't targeted at him. I don't know garage culture. I don't know what pull ropes look like, but it seems like a noose is an awfully complicated knot. And it seemed like it was only on that particular garage. That seems unusual. But if you're comfortable, maybe it hangs around there for some other reason. We don't need to get into that. I do think that Bubba should be commended for leaning in this moment, particularly if you understand the environment that he is living and working in. Like, he has an opportunity to just fall back and be like, all right, I created some progress and now I'm good. Like, no, I want more. I want you guys to understand and don't mischaracterize that. So all the assumptions that could be made about Bubba, considering his career path and other things about him, like, he is growing. He's a young man. He's growing into something else. And I like what I see. I would also, I just want to unpack for a second, like, how, when there is a hoax, but that hoax opens the door for people to talk about real things, I don't understand how people can hear that and then be like, oh, it's a hoax, and walk away. And like, the best theory I can come up with is like, the people who are in power are not accustomed to things that they have issue with building up. You know what I mean? So like, they don't have to wait to tell people that they mad about something. They don't have to wait for people to address issues that impact them and impact people they care about. It's something that we are accustomed to, where it's like, don't nobody care, don't nobody care. Flashpoint happens. All of a sudden, everybody cares about things that I care about. But if what created that flashpoint is a hoax, that doesn't change the fact that the things that are impacting me are impacting me. Can we still address this? Obviously, that was a bad hoax. Those guys, if something happened or whatever you're talking about, that was a bad thing. It was misguided. But it opened the door to something else. And y'all just want to say, oh, that was a hoax, and all this other stuff doesn't matter. That is like, I don't know. That's privilege, I guess.
Yeah, well, what you wind up having to do is you having to prove to white folks why they should give a damn about, like, your feelings. Like, that's what, like, the idea that you can't miss a free throw, right? Like, you got to make every single shot. And the second that you miss a shot, I'm always looking over my shoulder as the quarterback. And if I throw an incomplete pass, it may even got to be an interception. You going to pull me out and you going to put this other dude in the game. Like, that's what it winds up being all the time. And it's just like, part of where it gets bad is that, like, when white folks feel like a black person has lied to them or betrayed them, and you can look at this all over the place, like, that's the subtext of O.J. Simpson. It's not simply that he seems to have killed his wife and her friend. They felt like O.J. fooled them. You know, like, they felt like, oh, man, wait, I thought it was this. And then they thought that O.J. had duped them. And so anything that happens, or like your boy Jussie, the thing that gets people about Jussie is they feel like Jussie got over, right? Like, he tricked them and then he got over. Like, there has to be some punishment. Like, it's always like, yo, there's got to be some consequences that come to y'all when these things happen and everything else. Because people dared make white people for a moment care about what was happening to somebody black. And that winds up being the payback. So I look at him, at Bubba, and I'm like, nah, man, stand in yours, right? Like, you're like, no, they were not being ridiculous. There was a reason why we went and checked this out. And I applaud him, because I imagine the pressure on the other side is strong, man, real strong.
I texted you some of these questions. You ain't had no answers for them, obviously, because I'm not a car person. But, like, is that the customary knot? Like, is that on the pull that, like, is that doesn't seem to be.
From what I've gathered, there are knots that resemble nooses that are used as garage pulls that somebody like me might see and think was a noose, but was actually just a garage pull. That could happen. Right. But it doesn't sound like that was the knot that garage pull was in.
We have been talked about for a few days how there were only certain people allowed in there, right? So, like, only people who are part of race teams and understand race culture are allowed in there. If that knot was unique enough to grab the attention of someone who is on a race staff. Like, it's not normal. And it was the only, they didn't come back and say, nah, noose knots on every garage. It seems to me that this particular knot was unique. It was unique enough to grab someone's attention. It's possible that they did not put it there in order to intimidate Bubba, but it's also possible that that's something that someone put up and they like feel comfortable with it. It's jokey. It's cool. Like, that is another thing that we haven't necessarily addressed. I don't care so much about that as much as I care about the bigger systemic issues, but it is awfully convenient to come out and, oh, nah, he wasn't attacked. But it's possible, and I don't want to say it definitively because I don't know the culture and I don't know the techniques of knots. It seems likely that this was unique and it was tied like a noose and they are comfortable with that. Or to some degree, they've been comfortable with it since whenever it was put up.
Well, I tell you this, NASCAR going to get to the bottom of this one.
Yeah.
I don't think you got, like, the FBI may be out of this, but I think NASCAR going to wind up getting to the bottom of this one because they can't afford for this to go bad. They don't just have a black driver. They got a black driver who could be a star, and they know it. And I'm telling you, they've known it for a long time. They've been taking this dude around places for 10 years. To get him more shine and to get him more since he was 16, 17 years old. Like, I became aware of him when he was 17 years old because they brought him to the National Association of Black Journalists convention. I had no idea he was that young. You know what I mean? But they got to make sure this goes okay. Right. They want this to go okay. And by the way, they want this to go okay without having to do a serious reckoning with their past. Right. They just want to move on, and people are willing to simply let them move on. So they need everybody to keep it cool. Everybody involved has to keep it cool. Cause, and then, like I say, this ignores the fact what's going to happen the next time they show up at one of these tracks and the boys are rolling around with the flags, like you talked about, and they flying the banners over with the stars and bars on it, right? Like what NASCAR going to do then? Cause like at some point, and you notice I brought that up at Will over and over and over again. When is somebody going to talk about that? Because here's what NASCAR needs. NASCAR needs all of us to stand with them. Right. Like, they messed up. Mm. They waited way too long to do this. They tolerated this behavior for entirely too long. But it really does seem like they're trying to push back and stop it. And it'll be real easy for them to get weak in the face of a bunch of people showing up with the Confederate flag because they've gotten weak every other time. All those people are showing up with the Confederate flag.
You know, you ask what they're going to do. You know what they're going to do? They're going to say, remember back in Talladega? That noose was fake.
Exactly. That's right. And so they're going to need, literally, for all of us, like when I say all of us, I mean like media, all of us. They're going to need us at every turn to stand behind them and to support them and to shout down these other people, because that's the only way this is going to work, because these folk feel like this is theirs. They feel like it belongs to them. And they not going to give it up. Like, I don't know if I talked about this on this podcast or another
one. It is. It has been. At least. It has been there.
Yeah. But here's the thing, man. There's something about giving up these symbols that's just really hard for white folks. You know, but we can't, like, the eyes of Texas, the thing that's going on there, you know, with that one. The idea that you can, you know, somebody's like, well, they ain't saying the eyes of Texas no more. But we did that forever. The reason you like the eyes of Texas is because it's the song you sang at Texas. It is not particular. You'll be singing, I've been working on the railroad just for the sake of it. It's the same damn song, right? You love that song because it's the song of your school. If your school gets a new song, you will love that. Like, you ever notice how whoever the play-by-play man was for the baseball team or the basketball team or whatever in every city is a legend?
Yeah.
They're not all good. They just happen to be the guy that worked for the team that you loved and you associate them. So Woody Durham did the games at Carolina. I got no problem with Woody Durham, right? But Woody Durham left. Jones Angel got the job. Jones is in his late 20s, early 30s when he got the job. He's probably going to do it for 30 or 40 years. Is Jones Angel better at this than Woody Durham was? I have no idea. People are going to talk about Jones Angel the exact same way that they talked about Woody Durham because they're both the voice of Carolina basketball.
Right. You're right. I mean, I think that to go back to the conversation we were having earlier, like, I think it's just a human nature thing where it's like you get attached to these things. We were cleaning out since we're locked in our house. We've been cleaning out a bunch of stuff, and I am not the guy who like hangs up all his football stuff, his achievements. So they're in a closet in the basement. And so we're cleaning out stuff, and I never cared about this stuff before, but I got Pop Warner trophies and MVPs from high school and cutouts from when I was in a newspaper in a box that I'd never cared about. I'd never thought about. But like, it's a symbol That means something to me. And when I threw them things in the trash can, I felt a little like, this sucks. But you know what? This don't mean nothing. Like, who cares? Yes. Like, I was nice at football in 1994 amongst a bunch of kids. Like, I don't care. It's taken up over my house. So I threw all that stuff away. But I'm not going to say that there wasn't a pang of like, oh. Right. That's what happened. Yeah. Except theirs is mine is related to me busting ass some other little kids. Theirs is related to racism.
I need to get you and Joel Anderson on here one day talking about your childhood athletic exploits. By the way, let me tell you a fun story in line with what you were just talking about, though, with like finding stuff or throwing the stuff out. When we moved out of the house in Houston, this is in 97, we were going through like some shelves and stuff and getting things out. And we pulled out this cylindrical cardboard tube, right? And we're like, huh, I wonder what this is. Popped the top on the tube, pulled it out. Swear to you, my father's PhD. That thing was just laying around in the cabinet.
That's how you do it. I mean, because it's a symbol.
Yeah, it don't. It like the same thing with mascots, right? Like when you ask people to change the name. I'm going to give you guys a hint on something. Actually, Gabe, get ready for the elevator music on this, right? Dominique, I want to read to you the parting shot that I am going to do on Outside the Lines this weekend.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
That is
about to fire his ass.
Oh, I can't wait. Oh. That's going to be fun. Oh, that like those parting shots, they're often very good, but they stay in the world of the parting shot. Like, I feel like the following Monday, this is going to be a conversation. Like, people, you might be calling in the shows, calling in the boards, getting rejected from getting on air because people going to be talking about that.
Yep. You got to say. I got a point.
You're right.
I'm just giving them game. Right? I'm just telling them. I'm just letting you know right now, big dog. Like, if you do this, this is going to happen to you. You know? I think we need to hear more people with the live from, I think it's on Mainstream on the second Outkast album where Tebow's like, you think it won't happen to you? Did it do?
A lot of all the Outkast stuff, and I get hung up on all of Andre 3000's deep, deep bars that take me a years to fully figure out. However, you think it won't happen to you till it do? It's so straightforward. It's so real. That's always, you always told me that too, where it's like, don't be going over people's heads. Go direct at them. Like,
you're right. Yeah, that's like a reggae, right? You go listen to reggae. Like Cedric the Entertainer joked about that, the peanut butter, no job. But I was listening, one of my homies from grad school, my man Dave Jones from Delaware, and he's a big reggae fan, right? And looks absolutely like you would expect the biggest reggae fan to look, which is to say a redheaded white dude with fro. But Dave, I mean, but he's for real. Like, people don't know this about reggae. The people who like, you know, you go to a liquor store and they got a wine man, right? And they bring the wine man out. If you go to a record store and you want to talk to the reggae man, the reggae, and it's one of the wild things, like I read this in his Peter Tosh documentary. They just never could figure out why it was that black people never got on reggae the way that white people did. Like it was when the dancehall stuff came around, we talk about something different, but we talk about like that reggae. But anyway, I'm at Dave Jones' house and he's playing his group. I think it was called the Royals. And the hook of the song was, if you are not right, you are wrong. And you know what? That's low key profound.
Oh man!
You know what I'm saying? Like that is like that's the truth. Like if you're not right, you wrong. Ain't no equivocating. Ain't no rationalizing on the in between. If you're not right, you wrong.
That's a perfect song for this moment because that's how I feel. That's what I've been yelling about for several weeks now. Is like. You either pushing for the right things or you're bleeping up. And that's, yeah, yep. that's what's going on. So if you're not right, you are wrong.
You are wrong.
I'm downloading that Royals track immediately. You started this by saying they were trying to figure out why black people haven't really got into the reggae music.
Yes.
Is it somehow connected to these lyrics?
I don't know, man. Cause yo, I mean, the Wailers, like those gangsters, yeah. Right? Let me go through that Peter Tosh catalog. I mean, my favorite Peter Tosh line ever. If you want to live, treat me good. If you want to live, you better treat me good.
Nat Turner on the mic.
Yes. Yes. And my favorite Peter Tosh song, Buckethead Palace, which is about the Rastas breaking into Buckethead Palace and smoking weed.
I guess Tucson L'Ouverture would be a more accurate Caribbean reference.
Yo, man, Tucson L'Ouverture. You won't talk about a gangster, right?
One of his names is Dominique. I wasn't named after him. However, every now and then when people talk about him, I point that out.
Yo, like, here's the thing. Like, I was even thinking about this. Like, Denmark Vesey. You familiar with Denmark Vesey? South Carolina? Mm-hmm. I dare one of the Clemson players to be like, take Strom Thurmond's name down, or like rename the John Calhoun Honor College after Denmark Vesey and see what happens after they look up who Denmark Vesey is. Actually, I feel like that all this black history, they don't know. I bet they know who Denmark Vesey is, though. Like, no, my granddaddy told me about him.
Yeah, you just can't ask. You got to demand. It seemed like we got this momentum. That's what I've been talking about. It's like, let's shoot for the moon. Like, everybody talk about let's reform the police. No. Ain't nobody been paying attention like this ever. And y'all talking about reform the police? Like, that's let's go. Let's shoot for the moon.
You feel like they stopping short.
What are we doing? Like, what are we doing? Right now is, I think we all could admit, maybe of all time, but certainly in any of our lifetime, like, this is the most focus internationally on things that black people are grieved about ever. And y'all like, hey, let's ban choke holes. Man, if you don't get out of here with that.
Well, that's why that thing that we did under the elevator music, I have been surprised that that hasn't been louder. Right. And I think that part of it is, I think the largely affected demographic may not think it's their moment. No, baby. It's everybody's time right now. Y'all can come on in. It's cool.
I'm with you. I'm not trying to block anybody out. Let's remake all this stuff in the way that it's supposed to be. I'm not optimistic that it's going to happen, but I feel like if we're going to try, right now is the time to try.
Yeah. No, these are wild times, man. Like, it's just, I don't have easy answers for much of it or things up, but I do feel like this though. This is like whatever is or isn't going to happen. This is an important time right here because the new penny shine is off of this, right? This isn't what it was a month ago. Like, you turn on our network, for example, it doesn't sound now like it did a month ago. Like, right now, we're dealing with the actual sports news. Like, when it first came up, we didn't have any sports at all. But like the Bubba Wallace situation, for example, that's legitimate sports news. And you want us to talk about COVID? Because COVID is the next thing that is actually the news because it's what's going on with all these leagues who are trying to come back. But people think that's politics too. Like, right now, this is what sports is. Like, somebody came in my Twitter mentions yesterday and was talking about, do you even talk about sports anymore? I was like, cool, let's talk about last night's game. What you want me to do? And by the way, he did that in reply to when we tweeted out an article from If You Haven't Heard, a segment that we have been doing for 2 years in that fashion and sending out these links, right? Like, nothing about this is a change whatsoever. But like, right now, the sports is coming to places. Like, the idea that COVID is political, like, I always think it's ridiculous that we act like treating people fair is political. But like, the idea that the COVID situation is political right now, yo, that's absurd.
It is.
It's really messed up out here in these streets right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over everybody's timeline. I'm sure people fighting against wearing masks, like actually physically fighting, and also going before politicians, and also politicians arguing that somehow this is oppression. Trying to do your best not to kill your neighbor is somehow something that's political that is worthy of fighting against. Like, the same side, I mean, the false equivalency that somehow the wear your mask side is the polar opposite to the I don't have to wear a mask. Like, they aren't opposites. One is repugnant and one is humane.
Yo, my thing about the mask is it's so easy and effective. Like, do you realize how much we could fix if you just wear a mask?
Your football.
Right. And it ain't even got to be a fancy mask. Like, that's my, just wear a mask of some sort and it will get us so far.
Not nothing like, if you own two shirts, that mean that you can go to the store. You can put one on your back and one on your face. It ain't hard. Like, do you have a second pair of underwear? Do what you gotta do, man. Like, it seems to me, and that's so frustrating, is I think that's one of the things that, to delve into politics a little bit, that's frustrating, is one side has normalized something that is so far and extreme that the things on the other side now are, like, considered equivalent. And, like, that's not equivalent.
Yo, I was thinking about this as it relates to football. What mumbo jumbo you think Tom Brady out here telling these dudes as to why it's okay for them to work out together, even though everybody down there catching that, right? Cause like, I feel like Tom Brady has convinced himself that his Hall of Fame immune system. Tell me Tom Brady though. Tom Brady probably like Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory going to catch. I haven't had a cold before he died. I ain't had a cold in 20 years, right? Cause he eats like nothing but like fruit and orange rinds and like all this stuff, you know, peanut, make me some of that Dick Gregory, right? But he swore up and down he never got sick because all these things that he was doing and the food was killing us. Not that he didn't have a bit of a point, but you get where I'm coming from. Tom Brady got to be that guy, right? Because I'm sorry, man. No, I'm not coming to work out with you. It's not happening.
Even if it's true that he is immune, the rest of us ain't. The rest of that team ain't. They don't got whatever special Hall of Fame immunity you have, and neither do the rest of the people in the state and city that they're going around and spreading this thing on. Like, it's...
Yo, how about this? Are we sure that Tom Brady is allowed to come in the house? And I ask that because I don't know. What if Giselle is taking this super serious? She think it's what it is. And if Tom Brady go work out, Giselle is hitting him with... Giselle treating him like he a nurse. Right? Like, nah, you come in, you take them clothes off, leave them right there, go in the shower in the pool house, and then you could come back in the house around me and my children. Cause you want to go play concussion ball.
I feel like that's what Giselle should be doing. Like, she, and I mean, she's Brazilian, right? It ain't doing well down there either. Like, it's, no. So all her news feeds are hitting her with this Rona nonsense, and he going out and throwing these passes to guys in a park somewhere or at a high school somewhere.
Yeah.
All while he already got billions of dollars in 6 Super Bowls. What you doing this for?
And on top of that, you got a Brazilian supermodel as your wife, and you going to make her move to Tampa? What is there for her to do in Tampa? You know how tired she is of walking the streets of Tampa and somebody walking up and handing her a business card talking about amateur night on Wednesday?
That is what Tampa is known for.
That is what Tampa, my man Jeff Cameron in Tallahassee, he from Tampa, but he always talks about it. Shady Tampa. And this is how I feel about Tampa. It's just like Compton. You get outside that downtown Tampa and go like one exit. I was looking for a Popeyes once. I went there for work and I put it into Google's and I was like one exit away from my fancy downtown hotel. And it was very like hard edge Southern California looking, like the style of houses, the burglar bars and everything else. It was just like, oh, okay. I've done this before and I don't want to do it again.
More importantly, did you get the chicken or did you just keep driving? Like, nah, I ain't messing with this neighborhood.
No, I got it from the drive through. Right. Like, it takes a lot for me to get into a neighborhood and just be like, okay, I can't be here at all. You know, like I know places I don't need to be just like tooling around, but if I'm going somewhere for a purpose, it takes a lot. Now, I did get scared once when I first moved to Miami because, so one thing about Miami is, so in New York, let me give you the example. Fifth Avenue is the midline, right? And west of Fifth Avenue on 96th Street is west and east is east. But Miami works on quadrants. But I didn't realize that there was a difference between Northwest First Street and Southwest First Street. I just thought it was First Street. And so one day I'm supposed to be turning on Northeast Second Avenue. And instead I turn on Northwest Second Avenue, which is in a little place called Overtown.
Heard of it.
Maybe you've heard of it. All right, so I'm in Overtown, and I realize I'm in the wrong place. And so I'm like, cool, I'll just turn down.
You're in the wrong place unless you are a college scout.
Yeah, yeah, but at which point you better have a business card, right? So I decided to make a left, and I figured that I could just make a left and then get back to the street I was going on. Nah, man, that grid is set up like the Pac-Man board. Like, it tells you a lot about race in America. Once you in that neighborhood, they are not making it easy for you to get out. So, like, you know, you be playing Pac-Man and you make that turn and you get away from the ghost, and the next thing you know, you run into a wall. That happened to me on the streets. I looked up and I saw these two boys, and I don't remember what them boys were doing, like the particulars of it. It didn't matter, because all you heard from there was the clicking of the gear shift. Whoa, whew, me hitting that reverse and me getting right up out of there, dog. I was like, no, this is designed for the setup. And like Southern California, I could quickly tell what this neighborhood looked like in the day. Ain't got nothing to do with the night.
Yeah, I ain't never been to Overtown, but I've been in some bad neighborhoods, obviously. And that's one level of, I joked about this before, but like, that is the one black male privilege, is that you feel safe a lot of different places because nobody's looking at you like a mark. And I remember walking home, like in business school, we had some project and we live like a mile from the business school. And I remember leaving to walk home, call my wife, and it's like 1 a.m. and I start walking back. I got to walk through this park, and she's like, be careful. And I was like, what? And like, it never even occurred to me, because I've lived my life as a black man who wears hoodies, not looking like a come up. She's like, be careful.
Right.
They be in there robbing people. Who are going to rob me? That looked like more trouble than it's worth. Like, just a lonely black man walking around at 1 a.m. I'm good.
Yeah, that's what I thought that time I got robbed.
But you probably had on nice clothes. You probably...
Nah. I took a calculated risk, and it came up snake
desperation.
Eyes.
Desperation is a terrible
thing. Yeah, yeah.
The desperation that sent you into whatever neighborhood you were in at that moment, I'm assuming, in the desperation of the guys who saw you, I was like, maybe this is a come up. A lot of desperation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got set up. Like, it was a lot going on there. What's the worst neighborhood you recall being in?
Worst neighborhood I recall being in. Are you talking about in America? Because I went to Brazil. I had looked at some of these favelas, and like that is another level of poverty and desperation. But
yeah, that's what everybody tells me about Brazil. Like, my homeboy said in Brazil, when he was in Brazil for exchange, he's like, you got to watch out, because if they decide you got money, they coming for you. And he's like, they decide you have money by if you have shoes.
That's true. That's the point I was making. It's like, I don't look like a mark. I don't got nothing fancy on. But like, if I have on shoes, all of a sudden, you are marked. Yeah, that jumps out. I mean, I don't know. There's the rest of the neighborhoods, like Baltimore, obviously, except I lived there, so I spent so much time there, it didn't feel unsafe. Southeast, you talk about quadrants. Southeast in D.C. is the quadrant, but I never felt like unsafe. I'm sorry. I feel like favelas isn't the answer.
Oh, no. It's cool. I was just wondering, because everybody got stories. Like, I tell you this about D.C. So one time, I was meeting up with this woman. I hadn't seen her in a while. We was going to catch up, and she lived in Adams Morgan. Now, you need to understand, though, this is January of 2003. Oh, yeah. So what you think about these areas in D.C. now means something completely different, right? And so she's like, cool. Well, can you ride to the Columbia Heights train station? I said, cool. I rode to Columbia Heights, and I got out. Now, there's a Target in Columbia Heights right now, right? But this train station, I think, was at 14th and Irving. Woo, baby, I got out of there, and I'm like, oh, what is going on? And so I thought she was going to meet me at the train station, right? And I'm there, and I'm on the phone with my dad. I remember I just got this new fancy cell phone, and it was the night Michael Vick went ham at Lambeau in the playoff game. And I'm there, and old girl tells me, all right, so cool, like, walk down this street and, you know, whatever. I say, cool. Man, I start walking down that street. The street lights get darker. Everything on the wall is spray painted in Spanish, and it's just getting darker and darker. And I'm dressed to like go meet up with a woman. And I'm like, I went right back to that train station, and I called her, and I was like, I don't really know what's going on here, but I ain't really feel comfortable with that. She's like, fine, I'll come meet you. And then this 5'1", 109-pound woman just strolls through the neighborhood and comes and walks me to wherever it was that we ultimately went to. Look, I ain't you the neighborhood, right? I am not. I was like, I don't want no parts of this situation right here.
That's a smart decision. I think about the times when I felt most unsafe was a club in Baltimore called The Paradox. Anybody from Baltimore, I'm sure, knows about it, especially of this age. It was right by Raven Stadium underneath, well, the Raven Stadium wasn't there back when I used to go, but it was underneath the highway right by where Ravens Stadium is now. And it was a club I used to go to in high school. You know, those clubs that are like, that are for young people. And leaving that club, I would feel like there was a shooting there maybe 3-4 times a year. I would go anyway because of that desperation we talked about before. But every time I left that club, I was like, this could be it. This could be it. Cause everyone was hanging out outside looking for some trouble. And the bouncers was all there. Ex-police always getting in fights. That was the worst, being young and stupid. Other than that, I tried to avoid it. I had money when I was younger too, yep. which is another thing. Like when I, in my 20s, when I'm sure most of your stories That's are true. From, I was in the league and people was like, hey, don't go around here. Don't go around there. Don't get in trouble. And whatever.
Well, a lot of mine is the fact that I went to college in the projects, right? So I developed a comfort because, yo, I've been in Atlanta. I have been some places that should have felt more unsafe than they did. I just like you came. There's nowhere in Atlanta that you can really make me feel uncomfortable, except I don't know what Bankhead hitting on these days. But I once my car broke down at Bankhead once at 10 o'clock in the morning and I had to go to the wait for somebody to come get me. And I was waiting in my car outside a gas station. And that was I was shook. Like there was cats walking past that had me like, oh. And I used to go kick it like party on Bankhead at night. Nah, I ain't doing no dumb move. No. But like New Orleans, I've been a couple places in New Orleans where I was like the worst in New Orleans is just DC. I've been to a couple DCs where I'm like, ooh, what are we doing here? I went to go see my homeboy in Chicago and Chicago was like block to block.
Yeah.
And so I went up there and I was going to a party and I'm in a rental car. This is like 2011, right? I'm in the rental car. It was going to DJ Mike Hitman's birthday party, in fact. And so he's like, all right, I got to go inside and talk to my mom. And I was going to get in. He's like, nah, man, because if you come in, she's going to spend all night talking to you. You know what I mean? So I need you to wait out here. And I'm like, you need me to wait out what? it all came out of me right there. And I'm like, what about Chicago? Right? And he's like, oh, no, you good. This block is good. And he was right. That block was good. The next block I would have had to go inside.
I feel like this is one of those voicemail things that you need to open up at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that'd be a great voicemail segment because I'm sure people got better stories than I got.
Oh, yeah. Nah, man. Like bad, like that. I just wound up in a bad neighborhood. You're right. You had some bread and you knew that these were places that you did not need to be. Though I do find that somewhat bourgeois young men like yourself and me, what we do often have happen though is we go to college and we meet some friends who take us some places that they no longer think, that they don't think are dangerous because it's just what they do. And maybe it's not dangerous because you are there with them.
Yeah, I don't know.
But you look out the window and you're like, dog, where are we?
that's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think that is more that the desperation that would send people into those neighborhoods. I didn't have any problem with that. Like, I feel like I would have made a lot more risky decisions if a woman told me to come meet her somewhere. But being a college athlete and also being a professional athlete, like that was not the hang up, you know?
No, come over here.
There was no reason. Why would I go? There's no reason. There's nothing over there for me. Like anything that I need, I can get out here.
You know what? Also, and you know what that comes down to also is a part of it that happens because I didn't have a lot of money in my early 20s, but I had a little money in my 20s in a way that made me and my crew the dude that had some money, which also means that you got to fly a spot of all the people that you roll with. And so you don't wind up playing a bunch of away games because my crib is doper than whatever this other thing is. But then, you know, you had some teammates that was over there, like playing them dangerous games. Like we used to have dudes at the door that was dating the girls in the projects. And I'm like, yo, I feel like you're playing a game you should not be playing.
Yeah, that's very risky for a number of reasons. It's very risky.
No. Like my homeboy, he's now an Ivy League professor, was telling a story once about how some dudes was trying to jump one of his partners and it was only one of them left at some point. Either way, he showed up and then him and his boy is in New Orleans, chased the dude down, right? Like they knew that was trying to mess with his partner. They ran away and they kept running. And he said, finally that dude ran into one of them New Orleans projects. And he said, that's where the chase ended.
You good. I'm done with that.
Yeah. He was like, yo, in the project, he know where he going.
The most unsafe that I felt is probably on the University of Maryland, just off of University of Maryland's campus, which is not a bad neighborhood, at one of those bars, because the University of Maryland College Park is not that bad, but it's 10 minutes from DC. So we had a lot of DC players and a lot of players who would go to the DC clubs and they're football players and they would get in beef with people because we get in beef on campus. You just beat up the frat and you move on. They get in beef with the wrong people at these DC clubs and start fighting them. and everybody knows who they are. So they beat up some dudes who don't play that. And those dudes came to our little corner bar that we went to at Maryland with everything that you would expect them to come with, looking for football players. And I'm just there just trying to make me a new friend. And they in there, and then you with your teammates, you're like, what you gonna do? And these guys standing outside with tools and whatnot. And some of the people who are on the team are comfortable with that lifestyle, talking about, let me go back to my dorm. And I'm like, no, let's all just go to bed. And I can't leave, like, these my dudes. At this point, I'm like, man, what is we gonna do? Never been happier to see the red and blue lights flashing. Never been happier.
Man, the California Club in the AUC used to throw a picnic every year, right? And I remember we got out there, man, and that was the first time I had never seen that much weed in one place before in my life. Everybody's out there ripped, stanking, drunk. The music is cracking. And I remember I saw at some point some dude who had the California flag wrapped around his shoulders was getting the work. They was whooping his ass. And then I saw somebody hit him over the head with a bottle. And I was like, yeah, and we kept it moving. The next thing I knew, about maybe 15, 20 minutes later, buckle, buckle, buckle. Yeah. Everybody hit the ground, you know. A couple seconds passed. Everybody looked around. Party got back started. And I was like, all right, I drove. I'm out. This is it. I did not grow up like this, right? Like, This is a wrap. And my boy was like, they must not shoot at parties in Houston. I'm like, and when they shoot, I go home.
I don't understand that psychology where you're like, nah, this is the type of place where somebody let off some shots and we get up and get back to it. The record skip.
Yeah. Here's the thing about shooting. Typically people don't stop till they're done. Nah, man. Got my ass up out of there. Oh, man. Dominique Fosworth.
Always fun.
Check my bad out. Check about the undefeated. Check about Mondays are highly questionable. We do that thing on Mondays. I think it's I think it's entertaining 20 minutes of television a day.
It's the only day I'm on, so I determine it's the best day of the week.
There we go. Mondays. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsor, Hims. Also, taking a little time off next week, we are going to have an episode for you. That'll be an interview I think that you will find to be cool Tuesday morning. But I'm going to be out. Don't worry. Everything's all right. I just deserve a break. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.